unfortunately, it's gotten dragged into this conversation, but I don't think the death of Trayvon Martin has anything to do with the Castle Doctrine.
Baxley says 911 tapes that suggest Zimmerman was following Martin before the shooting show that the Stand Your Ground law should not pertain in this case. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Russia is against sounding the warning about the U.S. missile shield program in Europe. Today, Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov, that is, said the issue is a litmus test of whether the West is ready to consider Russia an equal partner in defining global security. Russia is concerned the missile defense system will undermine Moscow's nuclear deterrent. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care, on the web at rwjf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Allegations of phone hacking and bribery brought down Rupert Murdoch's British tabloid News of the World. Parliament is investigating, so is Scotland Yard. Dozens of journalists and top executives from Murdoch's papers have been arrested. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Lowell Bergman about his new PBS Frontline documentary, Murdoch's Scandal. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour, the program that you will hear comes from the Focus archives. It was first broadcast on March 22nd, so for this hour, we'll not take calls. In this hour of the program, we'll be spending some time talking about the history and promise of green technology. That is the subtitle of a book that we'll be talking about. The book is Powering the Dream, and the author is our guest for this hour, Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. He's also an award-winning former staff writer for Wired.com. He's a visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And we'll be talking about some of the things that now seem to be subject of current interest, kind of cutting-edge technologies, or sometimes seem to be cutting-edge, trying to take advantage of things like geothermal energy and wind and solar, so forth. The point that he makes in the book is this. More than a century ago, it would have been possible for someone to use the sun to heat hot water for their home. In 1900, you could take a ride across New York City in an electric taxicab. In 1945, you could have bought a solar home or a 1-megawatt wind turbine. So the point is here that green technology has been viable for more than a century, and the question is, why aren't we using it? That is some of what the territory is in the book Powering the Dream, and we'll be talking about with our guest, Alexis Madrigal. And Alexis Madrigal, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good. Thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it. I'm sure we can talk specifically about a lot of things. There's a rich history here. But I guess the big point to begin with is the one that I tried to sketch out in the introduction. And that is that the technologies that people are getting excited about now, things that I mentioned, trying to exploit the energy of the sun and the energy of the wind and other things, these are not new. They've been around for a while. So the big question is, well, since these technologies have been demonstrated and we know that they can work, why aren't we taking advantage of that?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, it's essentially why I decided I wanted to write this book. Back when I was, you know, it was kind of 2007, 2008 when I started researching the book. And I, you know, kept hearing all these sort of apocryphal stories about, you know, big solar farms out in the Mojave Desert or, you know, the wind industry making what were then called American windmills in Illinois in the 1890s and early 20th century. And I said to myself, you know, like, what happened to all this stuff? Like, why is it that there were literally millions of windmills scattered across the United States in the early 20th century, and now there are none? Was it just a simple case of technological progress, like that these things were in fact made obsolete by new things that were better? Or was it more complicated than that, and that there were many types of factors? And I think, you know, the book itself is structured as a bunch of sort of easy-to-digest stories because it turns out that each one of these technologies has its own particular path through American history. I mean, the best and most interesting example is the first organized car concern was called the Electric Vehicle Company, and it was based out of New York. And their idea was actually really big, and it's one that's come back into vogue. It was that cars shouldn't be sold as a product. You shouldn't buy the metal. What you should buy is the service of transportation. And that made sense to a lot of the big-time investors at the time because that's what they sold in the form of streetcars, electrified transport to get around cities. And there was an entire infrastructure across all of urban America for getting around on trolley lines. And so they saw vehicles, like wheeled vehicles, as an extension of that business rather than as an extension of the horse even. And so they tried to build this big integrated system. But what they found was it was actually pretty hard to connect everyone in the way that they wanted to, from going from electric trains to these electric taxi cabs that they were running in New York and other cities, actually across the Northeast, and also systems in Paris and Mexico City. I think, you know, possibly the dominant takeaway from, you know, the entire 20th century of energy innovation, both renewable and not renewable, is that no one factor really makes or breaks things. And I feel like that In the energy world, and I'm sure anyone who's had discussions with someone who's a fervent believer in solar or nuclear power or coal or natural gas, you know, they tell you, like, this is the dominant technology because it had to be this way. This is the dominant technology because the energy density of fuel, or because, you know, this is the progression of technology and stories like that. And I think when you go back and actually look at the history of these things, you find that there were all these moments where history could have gone a different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, that's just, since you were talking about transportation issues, and that we know now, for good or ill, and probably some people would argue mostly ill, that our economy really revolves around the internal combustion engine that's powered by a petroleum product.
Sure.
And some people would say, well, really, that was not an accident, and the reason that we are here is the result of a vast conspiracy involving the fossil fuel industry and government that's in their pocket. And that's what has happened, is that the fossil fuel industry has stamped out all possible competition. They've taken advantage of subtle advantages that they get from the government, subtle kinds of support and subsidies that makes it look cheaper than it really is, and that's the reason that we don't have green alternatives.
I think it's certainly part of the story that the extractive industry, fossil fuel industry, generate a lot of money. They're essentially pumping money out of the ground. And as a result, you know, particularly in the old days, like if you go back and you look at some of the early strikes, first in Pennsylvania, later in Oklahoma and Texas, the energy return on investment, so the amount of energy you had to put in order to get energy back out in the form of petroleum, was like 1 to 100. So essentially, for every unit of energy you put in, you got 100 back. And at a time when people were starved for power, I mean, they were so starved for power that they used to quantify the amount of access to power that people had in terms of, like, human laborers. So they would say, like, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s, they would say, Americans now have access to 75 human slaves worth of power, from petroleum products and from coal. And that just bare fact of, like, the usefulness of fossil fuels and therefore their saleability and therefore the amount of money that these fossil fuel companies could generate with the help of, you know, friendly labor laws, friendly transportation laws, the paving over of the trolley system that we were just talking about earlier, you know, throughout the 1920s and into the middle of the century, the social mores that made people want to isolate themselves in suburbs are the same types of things that made them want to drive cars instead of riding mass transport. Like, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of factors, and one of them, and a big one, is that when you have these incredibly profitable industries, you know, whether it's, you know, Exxon today, whether it's, you know, Standard Oil back then, whether it's Apple today, they have a lot of sway. And I think, you know, in these things, I went hunting for conspiracies. I mean, you know, I am a journalist, and I wanted to find exciting stories about things that had happened in the history of energy. But these systems are big and complex, and no sort of single actor is able to sway the entire course of world events. I mean, you do see things like the U.S. Highway system, you know, built, subsidized government funds, obviously drives oil use. But also had all of these Cold War implications, right? I mean, it was the ability to be able to move tanks around the country, et cetera. And I think that's, you know, that's the thing. I mean, energy is so deeply embedded in our society that it both influences everything, but is also influenced by all the other stuff, including, you know, our culture, including, like, you know, international geopolitics and these things. So as much as I wanted to find, you know, hard examples of conspiracies, you know, you don't really see it. Even, you know, a classic example of this, like Who Killed the Electric Car? I actually interviewed the director of that movie, who's got a new one out called The Revenge of the Electric Car. He's a great and very funny guy. But, you know, we were talking after the interview, and I was saying, like, well, you know, it makes it seem in the first one like there was just this horrible conspiracy. On the other hand, it's not as if any other car company was putting out a viable electric car. It's not like, you know, there was this, like, active suppression by the entire industry to shut down electric vehicles in the 1990s. Instead, it was more subtle than that, and there are a lot of reasons why we're only getting true electric cars now.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, Alexis Madrigal. He's senior editor, lead technology reporter for TheAtlantic.com, visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley, former staff writer for Wired.com, author of the new book, Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Tocapo is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, let me ask another really general kind of question, and this has to do with the argument that people make. They say, well, you know, green energy technologies, particularly, they're nice, and there's a little niche for them. But the big problem here, and this particularly applies to generating electricity, but if we're talking about electric cars, it's certainly connected. And that is that if you look at the price, what it costs to generate electricity per kilowatt hour, that solar, wind, geothermal, those things, they're just more expensive. They cannot compete economically with the unfortunately dirty and non-renewable kind of sources that we have. Coal, I guess, would be the big one.
Right.
And then also, though, natural gas is used to generate electricity. And then, of course, we have all the issues associated with nuclear generation. But the bottom line is that all those other things, with all the problems that they have, they're also cheaper.
Well, I think, you know, it's a fascinating topic, why and how people pay for electricity and what they consider to be part of their bill and don't. There's a couple of really obvious things that should be included in this debate. One is that when we know that coal causes all kinds of health problems, and we know that that's costing the economy as a whole, it seems ludicrous to me that we wouldn't include that in the cost of coal. It's like, you know, it's we're essentially handing the coal industry money. And, like, that's, you know, we may decide as a country that that's worth it, that cheap electricity is worth it, but it's going to impact people's health negatively, and we're going to bear that cost as a whole. So we want, well, essentially what we're saying, if we make that decision, is that we want coal companies to be more profitable, and we as a country would like to subsidize that. I mean, that's essentially the way that we price fossil fuel-generated electricity at this time. We let them put all of the costs on the country, and as a result, they themselves are more profitable. We also pay a slightly lower cost for our electricity. But again, we're subsidizing everybody who has, you know, I mean, lots of public health studies have been done about the negative impacts of the particulates. We're not even talking here about carbon dioxide, but the other types of emissions that come from burning coal. So that's one. Two is, in this country, the lowest cost electricity, the lowest cost power has not always been the one that has succeeded. The best example of this is nuclear power. The only insurgent power source of the 20th century. When we look at them, we see that the price of nuclear electricity was incredibly high for a very long time. It's only now that we've paid off the capital cost of these like 40-year-old plants that the per kilowatt hour price is low. And I think that's fascinating, right? Because it points out that the support of the government and the idea that something is part of our narrative of progress is one of the reasons why people choose particular power sources. It doesn't always come down to the per kilowatt hour price of electricity. And I think the last thing to note is that people tend to, particularly when they're talking about home generation solutions, we're talking solar in this case, or say small wind in Illinois, you know, they tend to compare the wholesale cost of electricity with the price that or the cost of generating electricity at home. But of course, you know, if you're a consumer of electricity, you're paying the retail price. And if you look at the retail price of electricity in a lot of places relative to the cost of generating solar electricity, particularly as the price of solar panels has continued to plummet, what you see basically is that it's a lot closer than you think. Unfortunately, there has been the problem of major upfront costs to be borne by consumers. And, you know, given what the economy looks like, it's not like there's a lot of free capital floating around. You can't exactly refinance your home, pull out, you know, $30,000 and put it into solar panels on your roof. But part of developing a solar industry in this country as well as around the world is developing the services that go around it, including leasing and financing models that allow people to, through companies like Sunrun and SolarCity, the companies pay for the upfront cost of the solar panels, and you pay less for solar electricity that's being generated on your home. And the crazy thing about this model is I think the number one thing working against them is people just don't believe it can work. But it does, and it's working in states all across the United States already. I actually am not sure about Illinois, but certainly in the Southwest, and in some states that have substantial subsidies in the Northeast, it's already working.
We have a caller and would be welcoming others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we are talking with Alexis Madrigal. He works for the Atlantic and is author of the new book, Powering the Dream, the History and Promise of Green Technology. Our first caller is in Belgium. That's line number four right here. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I have not heard your conversation, though I missed a short little period of it. I haven't heard you speak of something like the Bloom Box. Now, the Bloom Box, I'm sure you're knowledgeable of it. It seems like the Bloom Box would be a very good solution for some of these problems. Not, you know, it does use a propane-type source to produce the energy, but the propane source can come from many places, landfills, coal, any number of things where we can reform the compounds we have, making them cleaner and be used for electricity, which, by the way, can also be done at home and on demand, which might make it a lot more reasonably efficient because you wouldn't be pushing these wires all over every place, losing energy in those and various things we have just makes a lot of sense. Also, being a new technology, be a new area to generate some expertise and export throughout the world for our own good business.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak of that?
Sure, sure. So for listeners who aren't familiar with the Bloombox, it is kind of looks like a big like industrial refrigerator or chiller. but really what it is a system for burning natural gas and generating electricity right on site. There's a couple of really fascinating things about it. One, it's funded out of Silicon Valley, which has been a major player in pushing a lot of these kind of early stage technologies and trying to ramp them up. They haven't always been successful in that, but at least in the case of Bloombox, they continue to stand behind that technology. The other fascinating thing about Bloombox is that really there, and throughout kind of the latter part of the 20th century, there was this, there are two competing goods that people were trying to accomplish usually with cleaner energy technologies. One was they wanted to reduce the emissions and both, you know, traditional pollutants as well as carbon dioxide. But two was decentralization. There has been a thought running, kind of a counter narrative running throughout American history in the 20th century that we didn't want to centralize our power system around a few small major plants. That required too much transmission, and that system was possibly not as resilient to whatever types of shocks, either natural ones, war, earthquake, you know, et cetera, as a system that had a more diverse and greater number of power generation facilities. And so what you're seeing in the Bloombox is a kind of decoupling of these things. The Bloombox, sure, it's cleaner, right? I mean, in the sense that it burns natural gas instead of coal, and it also reduces some other types of pollution. But it's not, you know, it's not the a solution to global warming in a kind of narrow sense of thinking about solutions. I mean, it still burns fossil fuel. What it does accomplish is this decentralization task, and I think that's significant for a lot of reasons, and it's also significant for a lot of companies who need like ultra consistent power and want things under their control, like actually a lot of the high tech companies who have major data centers. So I think it's you know, the Bloombox is one of these things that is going to fit into the system of solutions that define our energy system, you know, when we are looking at it in say like 2040 or 2030. And I think that's the other, you know, important point to consider in all of when, you know, we're talking about all of these technologies. I mean, the energy system is so big. It's so big. And the most consistent trend that we've seen is that more and more types of energy are being tapped. So, you know, when we bring on, you know, lots of natural gas, the coal hasn't gone away. We've just brought on more natural gas. When we bring on more wind, we're actually not really getting rid of a lot of the other power sources. We're just adding more. And I think that is in and of itself a trend that's likely to continue. But it's also, if we're thinking about this in terms of you know, global warming, if we're thinking about this in terms of climate change and wanting to reduce the amount of carbon that we put into the atmosphere to generate electricity, we're going to need to turn back that very, very long-term trend and actually stop using some of the dirtier power sources. And, you know, while conceptually that seems like maybe it's a relatively easy thing to do, given that there are now these alternative solutions that are cleaner or have lower emissions, you know, these things are really embedded in our human affairs. And, you know, the cost of doing that would fall disproportionately on some states versus others. And that's made it very difficult to get consensus for things at the national level. And, you know, one hope, just to bring it back to the Bloombox, is that by decentralizing things, you put more control in the hands of local people, and local people can make the change that their national government has not been able to.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I think that that certainly it has been demonstrated that particularly a lot of these clean technologies, and I suppose I'm thinking of solar, wind, geothermal, have been demonstrated that on a small scale, sort of on an individual level, like powering a small building, like, for example, a single-family home, that those things can certainly work. And we have, as you cite in the book, you know, we have examples of people doing that going back some ways. Now, that's maybe a separate issue, and maybe that's the scale that we should be looking at. Having said that, though, what's sort of been the effort and the track record of trying to use those things and to do it on an industrial scale?
Right. Well, actually, you know, the most successful solar installation for, you know, from about 1980 into the early 2000s was actually in a, you know, an industrial scale power facility, solar power facility out in the Mojave Desert. I mean, it's been producing, you know, over 300 megawatts of electricity since the 1980s, and it's worked beautifully. That company that built it was called Luz, and it's one of my favorite stories in green technology. I mean, it was actually founded by software pioneer, someone who worked on the systems that were part of early word processing. He sold that company and actually went to Israel and was sort of, you know, working more on his sort of like religious practice. And then he, while there, he got really interested in solar energy, and he wrote this book, which I have probably one of five copies of, that was about a kind of solar-powered utopia. And so what he imagined was, because at this point, keep in mind that photovoltaic cells, the kind of solar panels that we think of, were so expensive that basically only NASA and actually oil companies on oil rigs tended to use them. So he looked at the solar technologies that were extant at that time, and there was one that used these sort of parabolic mirrors. Like imagine like a toilet paper roll, like sort of cut in half. And when you use that shape, you can actually concentrate the rays of the sun on kind of a line that's running sort of down the middle of that tube. And if you fill that that line with a heat-carrying oil, essentially you can heat up that oil enough that you can run it to a boiler and bring it into contact with water, or kind of like put it in around water, essentially, and it'll boil the water. And what that allowed them to do was generate steam, and of course steam is actually what drives our turbines and electrical generating apparatus as it sort of pushes these big blades that move magnets that then generate current. So this guy, Arnold Goldman, took this concept, which would now be called, you know, either concentrating solar or solar thermoelectricity, and built this company that, unlike every other company in the 20th century, was able to put in 9 plants in the Mojave Desert. They raised billions of dollars to finance and build these plants, and again, like I said, they're still working today. Unfortunately, as a result of some different types of political wrangling, their business was always the business model was kind of always right on the edge. Like it was good for investors and individual plants, but the investors in the business were always at risk of losing their shirts. And so they lost a property tax break that they had been given. Keep in mind, this was like the world's solar hope. This was like the biggest and most advanced solar company that existed on the entire planet. And the state of California cut their property tax break. And it broke their business model. They lost investors in their next plan, and suddenly this incredible momentum that they developed fell apart. They went out of business. And the plants continued to work, but the business itself of building plants went away. Keep in mind that all these plants were built during the Reagan and Bush senior administrations. Like this was not a friendly policy environment, and yet they were able to still do all these things. What's fascinating now is that after lying dormant for years, Arnold Goldman essentially he got the first engineer that he ever hired for this company. They got back together, and now they have a big company called BrightSource, which is in the process of building the biggest solar plant since the plants that they built in the 1980s. And what's fascinating is, like, this is one of those, you know, I was talking about those moments in history where we look at something and we say, wow, like, things could have gone a different way. Imagine if instead of people doing nothing for the years from basically 1990 to 2010 in terms of building these solar plants, imagine if that company had succeeded. Imagine the kinds of advances they would have made in driving down the cost of the technology. In fact, they'd already cut the price of the electricity that they were producing in like the 5 or 6 years from 24 cents a kilowatt hour, which was very expensive, to 8 cents a kilowatt hour, which was like bordering on competitive with natural gas. So, you know, I mean, this is one of those times where, you know, we actually had a technology that seemed like it could work, and just a bunch of other sort of political factors came into play and wiped out the technology for about 20 years. And now, of course, you know, when that happens to an industry, everyone leaves it. They go work on other things. And as a result, you have to you have to rebuild your workforce. You have to rebuild the technical know-how. And, you know, some researchers who think about innovation, who think about how you build new industries, say that really U.S. policy, when the energy business is hot, that is to say usually when oil prices are high, the government should actually not spend as much money as when oil prices fall or there are other concerns, because you want to run against the cycle. You want to provide a way for scientists and engineers and companies to survive during the lean years, not subsidize them during the fat years when all kinds of private money is flowing into the industry.
In this hour, we are talking with Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior editor and lead technology reporter for TheAtlantic.com, was a former staff writer for Wired.com, writes about scientific and technological issues, and is the author of a new book, Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It's published by DeCapo. And one of the things that he does in the book is to take a look at the history of some of the technologies that we're so much interested in now, things like using wind power, solar power, electric cars. And the point that he makes is that these technologies are not new. At least many of them have been around, have been demonstrated that they can work for more than 100 years. So the question is, well, given that we know these things can work, why is it that we're not taking greater advantage of them? And he says that it's an interesting and sometimes pretty complicated story. So you want to read more of it, you take a look at the book. I want to raise a question here that came in from somebody who was listening and wrote in an email. And it has to do with applying some of this technology. And I think, again, particularly we're talking about maybe wind and solar on the individual level. And here's the question. Do you think that it's plausible that people in suburbs or cities will ever be able to have independent energy sources such as windmills or solar panels? And are there laws in place? So it could be building regulations and codes and zoning and so forth, laws in place that actually inhibits the use of those kinds of things.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the stories that I didn't focus on in the book, although in retrospect I now wish that I did, was just to focus on the history of the regulation of solar panels, because one of the reasons why solar panels are getting cheaper, I mean, let's step back for 1 second. So their solar panels are getting much, much, much cheaper, and the question is, why is that happening? One is the actual technology itself is getting cheaper, like the actual, both the photovoltaic cells, the modules that they go into, and so on and so forth. And a lot of that has been American innovation. A lot of it has been Chinese manufacturing innovation. Both things kind of working together have been driving the price down, as well as possibly some fairly large subsidies on behalf of both the American and Chinese governments. But the net effect is that the price of the technology has come down. The other part of it, though, is what they call the balance of system, all the stuff that's not the technology. That price is also coming down, A, because people are figuring out sort of better ways of doing this as the market has continued to grow, both in Germany, China, and the United States, as well as other countries, and because the regulatory apparatus is friendlier than it used to be. And it's still not very friendly. I mean, one of the big problems for companies trying to sort of get to scale in terms of installing, you know, thousands and millions of panels is that every single jurisdiction has its own construction laws. around this sort of thing. And so they've got to go, like, if they want to build a big workforce across the state of California, right? I mean, there are thousands of municipalities that are going to have their own regulations about what and how they need to operate there, and, you know, what the rules of construction are in terms of putting these panels on roofs. So it's really kind of a limiting factor still for innovation, because they can't come up with standardized systems because the rules that that govern these things are not standardized. And it's kind of fascinating. I mean, in the past, it was sort of like individual activists like trying to get these rules changed, right? Like one of the big rule changes was the idea of just being able to plug into the grid. So the way that things work in most places now is that if you have a solar panel, essentially you can run your meter backwards, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're pulling power off the grid, you know, your meter is going up, and when you're generating more power than you're using, your meter is going down. And that particular rule, which is great for people installing solar panels at home, they don't have to deal with battery systems. Essentially, the entire grid acts like a battery, and they act as individual generators selling power back to the grid. That particular rule took a long time to get changed just to allow people to be able to do that. So there, in short, I guess the short story is that there's a long way to go for making things as easy as possible for people to put in their own power generation on their roofs or in their yards. But we've come a long way. The trend lines are good. And I think if we, you know, if people, this is something that the American people continue to support, which overwhelmingly they do. I mean, I think it appeals to, like, sort of right-wing kind of libertarian sensibilities around, you know, having control over your own energy consumption and destiny, and it appeals to the left in a sort of, like, communitarian, it's, like, good for environmental, it's good for the commons, essentially, to use less fossil fuels. So in essence, you have a pretty large constituency that supports these things. I think you'll start to see, or really continue to see, the regulations reshape themselves such that it's easier to put panels on your roof. David, you know, one thing I thought might be of some interest, mm-hmm. I don't mean to cut off your next question.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
The one thing I thought might be of some interest to your listeners is that the wind industry in the 1880s and 1890s was actually a really big deal in Illinois. And it was centered around Batavia, actually, where there were, like, multiple competing wind companies. And it's sort of, I guess I find it particularly fascinating because there was a company called Air Motor, which put together one of the kind of like first like industrial testing labs, you know, like if you think of like the ones that are maybe famous around like Edison or some of the ones in Germany. Mm-hmm. Like they actually figured out how to model the wind accurately or at least more accurately than they had before so that they could reshape the shapes of the blades themselves. So there are multiple companies working on this, but there was one guy in particular by the name of Perry who essentially mounted all of these windmill faces on a big arm that was rotating around powered by a steam engine. And by rotating it around, essentially what you created what he called artificial wind. And then they could see actually how much power they were able to get out of the different types of shapes of these blades. And what's significant about that is it really converted the windmill industry, which at that point was kind of more mom and pop, into like a big kind of like proto-industrial enterprise. So it was actually a lot of the methods that they use and ways of thinking were later used in other types of manufacturing that we know better. So if you think about cars, for example, or before cars, bicycle manufacturing when that took off in the 1890s. And that was really that was a native Illinois industry. I mean, it was really the heart of an industry that put out, by some estimates, 6 million windmills before the 1930s. So like from, you know, 1840s to 1930s, 6 million windmills, which would make it something like the most powerful personal power technology outside of, say, the oven.
Wow.
or you know, the fire, the hearth, and really a way of doing industry that was later copied by many other people.
Great. Well, I've got another caller here, and we're headed into about our last 10 minutes with our guest, Alexis Madrigal. He's the author of the book, Powering the Dream. It's about the history of green technology. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have what is either a wonderful example or a horrible example of how regulations can cause people a lot of trouble. My daughter and her family live in Cupertino, California. Mm-hmm. They, several years back, decided to tear down their old house because it was very old and too small, but they wanted to stay in the neighborhood. So they had to submit their plans to city people over and over and over again about this, that, and the other. They wanted to put solar panels in, but they discovered that if they did, they would have to pay an extra fee to do that.
Yep.
So about a year and a half or two after they finished building their house, the city began giving people tax benefits for putting in solar panels.
Yeah, it's actually, you're right. It's a perfect example of the sort of conflicted nature of our current policies, right? I mean, I think you've got so many different levels that get into these projects, which are kind of, you know, it's kind of like redoing your kitchen, and it's kind of like changing the world's energy system. It's like, it's kind of both things. And you really see that at play when you have sort of, you know, the local planning officials being like, well, actually, you have to pay us to put solar panels. But then you have, you know, the city council wants to, like, you know, make good with Greens in California. And so they say, oh, actually, we're going to give you know, tax benefits.
Right. Well, anyway, they sure built their house at the wrong moment.
But
not really. Of course, they needed it then.
Yeah.
But I have encouraged my daughter then after her last child goes off to college to run for city council.
Yeah, right, and standardize things. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, I think it's something. You get companies that have been putting in power plants for a long time. You know, they both have reshaped the law to make things work better for themselves and, in all fairness, for a lot of people. And they also have teams of people who can get this stuff done. You know, it's not something where you're just an individual trying to figure out how to get something done. And I think, you know, when we look at different models for change in technology, right, there's the sort of big ones where it's sort of like, all right, we're going to change from coal to putting some things on nuclear. And it takes, like, you know, 7-8 years, and, you know, there's all this money invested, and there's all these, you know, government processes. And then there's, like, going to buy a new phone on the other end of things, right, which is basically like you go buy a new phone, and boom, now you're talking, you know, 5 minutes after you leave the store or while you're still there. And I think, you know, the real question is, like, can you have an energy system where you purchase, where it's easy to purchase new technology like your phone, but that can actually have the size effects that building big nuclear plants or new natural gas plants using fracked gas or whatever can, the kind of scale of change that can affect. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we can, actually, but I also recognize that, you know, at an individual level, it's quite difficult.
Yeah. Two, I want to thank the caller for the story. Again, we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left. One of the things that I think that people often argue is that for green energy technologies to develop and thrive and get to the point where perhaps they can stand on their own, what they really need is a very aggressive kind of support from government, particularly the federal government. Now, interestingly enough, you know, you go back to the experience of Luz International and the people who built what had been and I guess what still is the biggest industrial level solar plant ever. You know, this was, as you noted, this was at a time when there were administrations that weren't necessarily being seen as big friends of green industry, but it happened. So that suggests, well, maybe that doesn't have to be the case. But what about that? Is this something where particularly the federal government really has to take a big hand?
Right. Well, it's interesting. Luz is actually kind of a great example, because one of the reasons why Luz got built was, in fact, federal legislation called PURPA, which gave tax breaks essentially to small scale as well as clean energy facilities, combined with the implementation of that federal legislation at the state level in California under Jerry Brown. There are two real answers here. One is no power technology has ever succeeded without government help. The solar power plants that Luz built were based on Department of Energy technology. They just kind of took it the last step. So the real question has become, like, where should government deploy its resources? Like, a lot of that ties into all of this literature about what are the best ways of innovating. At some level, it's about having, like, breakthrough technologies, like you hear a lot, right? It's about, you know, early-stage research that yields totally new facts about the world or about the way we can interact with the world, and that completely changes the cost of, you know, doing something like turning the sun's rays into electricity or into fuel. On the other hand, it's about deploying things at scale and driving down the cost of things by learning by doing. And you kind of need two different types of government support for those things. And I think that, like, a smart energy policy would try and find those things. I mean, solar panels are a great example, right? There's government research to drive down the cost of the panels and the photovoltaic cells, the kind of research that helped us develop ways of learning how to frack, helped us develop nuclear power, helped us develop pipelines, helped us develop the power grid. So there's that kind of thing. But then there's also, right, all those other, the balance of system costs, I called them earlier, all the stuff that's not the panel. And for that stuff, you need, you know, help with deployment. And I think because you've never had a power source succeed without government help, you basically, you know, it would be unfair to ask renewables to do what other power sources have not. So that's part one. The question about where that support should come from, at the federal level, at the state level, my personal feeling is that, you know, at the federal level, I spent some time in D.C. over the last couple of years, it's hard to get anything done there that makes a lot of sense. I mean, state legislatures have their own problems, but at least the problems are closer to home. You know, they're more specific. And so I would love if we could see more support coming from states and even from cities in terms of how we can do all these things, because all of these problems are kind of fractal and they can be solved or partially solved at every level of scale.
Okay, so we got about 2 minutes here. And there are, I would certainly direct people to the book, because there's a lot of really interesting stories here, particularly about the ups and downs of various sectors of the green energy industry. So, but now you, as somebody who has really looked at a lot of this, as where we are now and where we have come from, do you have thoughts about particular systems or particular forms of generation where you really think are the where the most exciting potential is?
I think, like, the combination of solar photovoltaics with, like, smarter power information systems is really where you can see things going. I mean, I think any time you can hitch on to the back of Moore's Law, which is, you know, which says that power, computers are getting both cheaper and more powerful, it's a good thing. And I think when we think about power grids, how they used to work before, one of the reasons that it was cheaper to run these big power plants is that it was easier to operate the grid when you had a fewer number of facilities to deal with. But now, with smart grid technologies coming up and with lots of solar power, solar panels going out to homes, we're able to have a lot more intelligence about what's happening on our grid. And I think that's just going to make it easier and easier to incorporate these increasingly cheap solar panels. And so a lot of the, you know, you could see a substantial percentage of our power coming from solar, and you could see a substantial amount of our power coming from natural gas, particularly now that the push is on from fossil fuel forces to switch to natural gas, because we have it, at least in some form, in large amounts here in the United States.
Yeah, of course, that leads to, there's another at least one more program.
It's a whole other program.
A whole other program there because of all the controversy involved in what's in environmental impact of extraction. We'll save that for another day. But just going back particularly, because we have demand for power 24/7 on demand, that's when we want it, and particularly if you're talking about solar and wind, the sources aren't always there. What's the possibility that we're really going to be able to develop some good way to store the power generated when the sun is out, when the wind is blowing, so that when it's dark and when it's calm, we can still get it?
Storage is tough. I mean, I am kind of the opinion that, you know, the solution is going to be more in the system, changing the system so that we can move power around more efficiently than it's going to be in the storage of electricity per se. That will play some role, but I think that it's going to be knowing where we need power and being able to get it there effectively, to route it more like we route things on the internet than we do, than we have in the past.
A lot in this book, so I would say to people, if you're interested in learning some about the history and promise of green technology, that's the subtitle, look for the book Powering the Dream. DeCapo Press is the publisher. The author, our guest, Alexis Madrigal, he's senior editor, lead technology reporter for TheAtlantic.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
WILL news reporters and contributors won 6 awards in the 2011 Associated Press Journalism Excellence Contest, including Best Investigative Series, Best Documentary Series, and Best Sports Story. Reporters Sean Powers, Jeff Bossert, Jim Meadows, Tom Rogers, and Dave Dickey, along with commentator Lisa Braltz and Pam Dempsey of CU Citizen Access, were recognized in the contest's Downstate Radio Division. Congratulations to them and to you for making this coverage possible.
Support comes from the Seaboat in Champaign with a Southern-style menu featuring the Seaboat sandwich, 2 pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce. Also, collard greens, fried okra, cornbread, baked macaroni and cheese, and spaghetti. The Seaboat on West Kirby across from County Market. Delivery and catering at 351-6200.
Just a moment here, we'll have the afternoon magazine for you. I'll take the time to tell you about what we'll do tomorrow on the show. And once again, the programs will be coming from the Focus Archives. In the first hour, this is a show with Peter Coleman. He's director of the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. And we talked about that very question and how it is that you deal with conflicts and that percentage of global conflicts that are really stubborn. Those things that just don't seem to want to be solved. This is something that he has written about in a book that he titles The 5%, because he makes the argument that of all of the big conflicts that we deal with, one out of every 20 ends up in a stalemate when things get locked into position and it seems impossible for that to go anywhere. That's what we're talking about when we use the phrase like the 5%. But he does have some ideas on how that 5% actually can be solved. So we talked about that in this show. And then in the second hour, you'll hear an interview that I did with Dr. David Ansel. He is now the chief medical officer at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. But back in 1978, when he was fresh out of med school, he went to Cook County Hospital for his internship. At the time, it was ground zero, he says, for all of the crucial questions facing the U.S. healthcare system. And those are questions, he says, we still face today. He has written a memoir about his experiences there as a young doctor at Cook County Hospital, and we talked about that on the program, and you can hear that tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour. The schedule is there on the website, and you can check it out anytime you want. Also listen to past programs by going to WILL.illinois.edu. And that's it for us on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for that show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. You are tuned to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, May wheat is trading at 673¾. That's down 1¼. July, 682½. Down 1¼. May wheat in Chicago up 3¾ at 640. The July contract 649½. Up 3¾. May corn 641¼. Down 3/4. July 639¾. Down 1½. September 579¼. Down 5¾. December 553¾. Down 2¼. May soybeans 1345½, down 9½. July 1352½, down 9½. August 1344½, down 8. September 1324½, down 9. May meal 369.20, down 60. May soybean oil, 53.67, down 71. April live cattle, 125.30, up 35. June, 122.37.5, up 42.5. April feeder cattle, 153.90, up 80. April lean hogs, 85.52.5, up 55. Outside markets, May crude 104.95, down 2.32. The U.S. dollar 79.69, that's up 4. The CRB index 312.15, down 383.